It's the wire.co.uk podcast, episode 94 for Friday, the 21st of September, 2012. On the show today, NASA has revealed that the warp drives of science fiction may soon be science fact. The Philippines has declared legal war on cybersex, and Russia reveals that they've been sitting on a vast supply of diamonds that they've just forgot to mention. Also, we'll find out about the most significant launches at the Tokyo Game Show and try to get our heads around why a team of Dutch clinical psychologists made volunteers poke cows' eyeballs with needles. All that and more coming up. Hello. I'm Olivia Solon and I'm the Associate Editor of Wire.co.uk, and joining me today is reporter Liat Clark.
Hello, hello.
And online assistant David Cornish.
Hello.
David, this is your first time proper on the podcast.
It's really nice. I got to sit in and watch last week, but now I get a microphone.
You actually get a microphone. How does it feel?
It feels empowering.
And how are you feeling, Liat?
I feel great. I feel intimidated by his dulcet tones.
Excellent. Now, this is obviously the second time only that I've been able to host the podcast. Feels a little bit strange. Our dear leader, Nate, is currently at the Tokyo Game Show in Japan. And this is really significant because ever since I joined Wired about 2 years ago, Nate has just talked about Japan the whole time. He is a huge Japanophile, I think the word is. So it's great that he's made it out. And so we'll be hearing a bit from him a little later. But anyway, let's get on with the news. So, David, warp drives, the ones we see in Star Trek, faster than light travel, might be possible soon?
Yeah, well, NASA physicists say that warp drive is actually more feasibly possible than initially thought. So, warp drives, or Alcubierre, is that the right one?
Alcubierre.
Alcubierre drives.
If he's Mexican.
Named after a Mexican physicist who proved them possible, are a staple of science fiction, such as Star Trek. But until now, they've been thought impractical. Essentially, the theory behind them is that they would work by using a wave of energy to distort space-time, condensing it ahead of a ship that's travelling through space, but expanding space-time behind it with a ship floating along in a bubble in normal space-time. So the bubble with a ship would ride along ahead of an expanding space-time towards condensing space-time like a surfer riding a wave, which would mean that the ship had moved relative to space-time around it faster than the speed of light.
Okay, but until now, although it's theoretically possible, we've never thought this would be a practical possibility.
No, not at all, because the massive impracticality of it is the amount of energy it would need to actually create this spherical bubble of space-time. So in order to create it, you'd need an equivalent mass energy of something about the size of the planet Jupiter.
Okay, so what's changed? What have they discovered?
Well, Harold White from NASA's Johnson Space Center, speaking at the 11 Starship Symposium, which is a gathering to discuss how to send a spaceship to another star within 100 years.
What an awesome sounding symposium.
I want to go. Well, they say they've done some calculations, which I'm sure are very complicated and go over lots of different bits of paper, and say that warp drives are actually far more possible than they had previously thought. So if a warp bubble is actually a donut shape rather than a sphere, then you'd need only about the mass energy of the probe the size of a Voyager.
Okay.
So it's a lot less.
Much more feasible.
Yeah.
However, that doesn't mean we're going to be doing faster than light travel anytime soon, does it?
No, because first of all, we don't actually know how to make a space-time wave that could actually change space-time on the scale that we need.
Minor detail.
And we don't know how to make a bubble, let alone what it would be made of.
Isn't the energy levels are still a long way off?
They're still a long way off. Yeah, Star Trek, they use a matter-antimatter engine and they force plasma through warp coils.
That's
what
I'd use.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Yeah,
but
that would be my first.
The only thoughts that we've got at the moment are that we might be able to use dark energy. But the problem with dark energy at the moment is that we don't know anywhere near that much about it or if we can even harness it. So
We don't really know much.
No, we don't. NASA, as I say, they've made it more possible than was previously possible. But the only change is that they've said we'll go from a bubble to a donut-shaped bubble.
Okay, but so we're likely to all be dead by the time any progress is made on this.
Optimistic.
It's definitely not going to happen in our lifetime.
On the bright side.
Yep.
So from space-time distortion to something altogether more pedestrian, but no less exciting to some factions of society, the iPhone 5 launch. How are we feeling about that?
I've got tingles.
Excitement pants?
I unfortunately have just upgraded, so no.
No, okay. Well, we did actually talk quite a bit about the iPhone 5 last week. Nate got his hands on it, and as predicted, it had all the features that everyone had been leaked out in advance. But Apple has also just released, 2 days before the iPhone 5 went on sale, or goes on sale, it's actually today, I think, Friday, if you're listening. Apple's launched the sixth version of its mobile operating system, iOS 6. Now, it's been in beta since June, but just like the iPhone 5, it seems to be about very much about refinement rather than any kind of revolution. The most notable changes, maps. What a furore there's been about the maps.
Dear.
Apple has remade its own proprietary map system to try and rival Google Maps. It bought up a number of different map companies and it's created this kind of new mapping system. And it has turn-by-turn driving directions and it'll do things like read aloud your directions in the Siri voice, which may or may not be annoying. And it then has these 3D capabilities, which in principle sound pretty cool.
They sound very cool.
But in practice, they haven't worked out so well, have they?
No.
Might also be a problem that they have huge areas of the country missing.
Yes. So a lot of people have been very, very angry about this. But in the grand scheme of things, not too bad to have one problem with their Maps app. And it's sure to improve, I reckon. But they also don't have things like public transport routes. And finally, the privacy settings. App developers have to ask your permission to access personal data on your device. And you can now go through each of the apps and see which information the apps are accessing. And then very easily turn that on and off, which I think is a great move for anyone worried about their data. But one of the interesting things about all this, I mean, I'm really pleased that at Wired we don't do the stories where we go and queue up outside the Apple Store. Perhaps Nate might want to, but queue up outside the Apple Store waiting for the next launch of the product. It's, you know, for me, that's something that's really tedious about some tech journalism. However, this year, iPhone 5 launch, something interesting happened. There's a couple of guys in a social enterprise called Crowd Fueled Causes who took the front place in the queue at the Apple Store in Regent Street. And they're now auctioning off their place to raise money for a bakery that will support vulnerable women. See, I think this is a great initiative, and it's the first time I felt it's worthy to report on the queue at the Apple Store. But anyway, let's move on. Also trying to support vulnerable women, sort of, is a new cybercrime act in the Philippines. Liat.
Yes, the Philippines president has just signed off on the Cybercrime Prevention Act, which pretty much does what it says on the tin. It's due to criminalise a whole series of activities like hacking, identity fraud and child pornography. But the two things that have really got people up in arms are the ban on cyber sex and the fact that they've added communication via computers to their existing libel laws.
Yeah, so the cyber sex thing, the theory behind it was about protecting women who are forced into the sex trade in the Philippines, which is a big problem, right?
Yeah, there's been a bit of a trend of also kind of setting up these rings where they coerce young girls to act as cyber sex chat girls.
And, so kind of good intentions, perhaps?
Perhaps, yes. You'd like to think so. But the wording of the law has people troubled. I think the exact wording is the willful engagement, maintenance, control or operation directly or indirectly of any exhibition of sexual organs or sexual activity with the aid of a computer, blah, blah, blah.
So if you're willfully having cyber sex with your boyfriend across the other side of the world, hypothetically speaking, that could potentially fall under this law.
Exactly, yes. There's nothing really in the wording of the law to stop that happening. And obviously the young girls who are being coerced are not willfully taking part. So to have that kind of terminology in there leaves it wide open.
Wide open for misinterpretation.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously going to be pretty tricky to enforce. So you'd hope that the worst case scenario is not going to happen. But in the case of the libel law, it's kind of worse because the way the law is written, it's just an add-on to the existing law, which covers things like print, paintings and theatre.
Yeah.
But there's no mention of who exactly would be at fault. So is it the blogger? Is it the domain owner? Like, where would it stop?
So hang on. For example, I say something defamatory about a celebrity in a tweet or no, in a Facebook post. Mm. And then several people like it and comment on it. The people are wondering whether it's me who's responsible, whether it's Facebook who's responsible, or whether the people who are even liking or approving or retweeting stuff are responsible.
Exactly. Yeah. Basically, freedom of press activists have been out in arms saying that is exactly the kind of problem that anyone could be at fault. And coincidentally, the senator who actually added in the law at the last minute without any public hearing,
yeah.
has been accused in the past of plagiarising his speeches. But he made a bit of a blunder ahead of the libel law going into the act by saying people would be accountable for what they say or write. And that was before anything happened. They hadn't even mentioned the libel law. As far as the public had known, libel was not in the Cybercrime Prevention Act. So
they slipped it in the last minute and it got put through the Senate over there.
Yeah.
And so it got kind of rushed through and now it's law.
Yeah, it is. And his words are a little bit creepy. So people now have to be more cautious about what they write. So...
Yeah, and didn't he mention things like people like celebrities and politicians would now be safer from the world of horrible bloggers?
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, the fear amongst the public is that the libel law will be used for things like that, and it's just a waste of time. There's a lot more important areas of the act that should be focused
yeah,
on.
Yeah, so the actual vulnerable people won't be protected and it's so broad it could be interpreted in any way.
Mm.
Okay, well that's worrying, but hopefully the campaigners will be up in arms and perhaps they'll be putting pressure on the government over there. But from the Philippines, we're going to move over to Russia, where it's been revealed that for the last 40 years, they've been sitting on an enormous diamond mine that they just forgot to mention to everyone else. David.
It sounds like something out of a James Bond film.
It's amazing.
Which, it's a very cool story. So essentially there is a place called the Popeye Crater, which sounds awesome. Popeye Crater in Siberia, which is the fourth largest known crater in the world. It's very well preserved. It's 100 kilometres wide and it's thought to have been formed about 35.7 million years ago when a meteorite, roughly the size of 5 to 8 kilometres wide, smashed into it.
They've really kept it hidden.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. How you sit on a hole that wide, a crater that big, I don't know. But, well, what they've been keeping quiet is what's underneath this crater. So Soviet scientists discovered diamond deposits in the 70s underneath this crater. But at the time, they already had a massive mine called the
Mirny.
You're helping me with all the pronunciations. Thanks, man. It's the second largest hole in the world. You should look it up online. It is a spectacular build. Just a vast, like, whirlpool-like crater in the middle of the
it's so large. I was going to say that the helicopters aren't allowed to fly over it because they might get sucked in from its own air system that it has inside this hole.
Get sucked out. So anyway, the Soviets already had this mine operating further to the east of the crater, which was making lots of money, so they didn't actually need to exploit the diamond deposits underneath the crater.
They'd also that problem when you've yeah
I know oh we've already got loads why yeah. Just don't tell anybody about those ones because actually they didn't want to tell anyone just in case it affected the diamond markets and reduced the cost of the diamonds that they were already making.
But they're an interesting type of diamond, isn't it? It's an asteroid. I can't remember what the actual term is, but it's one formed when an impact diamond
exactly.
lands on Earth, and they're a particularly hard type of diamond allegedly.
Yeah, which confused me. I didn't know what there were different types of hardness of diamond. I thought it was all just carbon getting crushed, but it's been crushed at a different rate, so rather than being compressed over many, many years, it's a sudden impact diamond. And so yeah, these they occur when a graphite deposit is hit by an asteroid or a meteor. And there's another fun name for me to try and pronounce now. Nikolai Poklenko, the director of the Novosibirsk Institute of Geology and Mineralogy, says these diamonds are twice as hard as normal diamonds due to their structure, with unusually abrasive qualities, and thus have a more of a scientific or industrial application.
So they could be used for drilling.
Drilling.
And I don't know what other hard.
If you ever need to cut devices. Through anything, like so with a drill bit or a saw blade or some sort of, grindy abrasive action, then these are the diamonds you want to be coating your blade
so
with.
So it's this as opposed to, say, like, you know, the sparklers that people are getting engaged with.
Yeah, I'm sure there might be some down there that are big enough to put in a ring, but they might be that then they aren't as easy to cut for aesthetically pleasing purposes. It might just be that they're really easy to put on a saw blade.
And I think you mentioned before that the manufactured diamonds, often that sort of diamond, the cutting diamonds, are more easily manufactured and can be just as effective. So that might be another reason why they didn't think to exploit this diamond mine, but odd that they didn't mention it.
Yeah.
So how many diamonds are down there?
Well, the statistics are apparently that there are trillions of carats. Trillions. So, and a carat is the unit of measurement. It's 200 milligrams. So that's hundreds of thousands of tons of these carats of diamonds are down there. So it's enough to supply world markets for 3,000 years, give or take.
I don't quite know how they made that calculation, because obviously it very much depends on the demand. There's demand for sparklers,
exactly.
which this probably doesn't include. However, it's it's a pretty impressive volume of diamond.
Yeah, the numbers get even sillier. Apparently, at current market value, that would equal about $250 billion. So it would flood the market, but lower their price instantly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But then, well, there are other considerations. I think someone pointed out in our comments that the things like the cost of extracting the, yes, the diamonds and the quality of them, blah, blah, blah. But still, this is a really significant find. And as you say, I just love the idea of some kind of Soviet ruler just deciding not to declare these trillions of diamonds and kind of...
Yeah, I like the idea of it becoming a James Bond theme in the future. So like a bad guy discovers, I don't know, there's a carbon deposit under Brazil and he's going to smash a meteorite into it to make the world's largest diamond mine, and James Bond has to save the day to stop him from doing it.
I really hope that is not a plot for a movie. Anyway, I think it's time for us to take an ad break, and when we come back, we'll find out what poking a dead cow's eye with a needle has to do with sex.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Welcome back. Now, any young listeners, I know we have a school who listens to our podcast, they might want to turn down the volume for the next few minutes because this story is... has got some quite adult content in it. Mm. We're talking about a study that's come out of Holland, Dutch, that's the country. Well,
crazy
done me.
Dutch.
Dutch clinical psychologists who've done a study and they've discovered that sexual arousal in women seems to dampen an evolutionary disgust response. Okay.
Well,
is it okay?
Oh, right. So, well, that's the prep. That's the kind of.
They began with that as a starting
that's
point.
That's the kind of starting point. Now, this works on the premise that humans have to continually strike a balance between two evolutionary functions, sex and disgust. We need to reproduce on one hand, but on the other hand, we need to make sure we don't get infections and we need to avoid kind of gross things. And the theory is that, you know, we need a natural defense against things like other people's body fluids to make sure that we don't pick up nasty diseases.
I'm very glad I have that defense. Mm.
Yes.
I'm often repulsed when I look at mouths.
Exactly. And so supposedly, in order to be able to have sex, women, and I don't know why it's just women.
Just women?
This study only looked at women. Seems to have to overcome their sense of disgust to get into bed with someone. I mean, I can see that being the case in some situations.
Well, I have to say there was a previous study with men, just so that we don't think these guys are complete sexist.
Yeah. And the study said the same thing?
Yes, the study had the same results.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Okay, so men and women both need to overcome their...
We're all just living in
a disgusting world.
We've got our own burdens.
Now, I personally think there are a huge amount of unanswered questions about this and about the kind of premise of the study. But what's interesting in this case was the kind of tests they had to devise for the volunteers. So first of all, they took three groups of women. One group was the sexual arousal group, and they were made to watch an erotic film. Another group were made, they were the positive arousal group, and they were made to watch an extreme sports film. So, you know, they get excited, but perhaps not sexually excited. Unless,
depending,
you know,
on your thing.
Depending on your fetish. And then there was a third group who watched a train ride, and they were supposed to be in the neutral group. But again, I mean, that could depend on what your thing is.
Some people love trains.
So after doing this to arouse them or not arouse them in the right way, they then made them do different tasks. And this is where it gets really weird.
Oh, grim.
So the first one was they were told they had to hold a bone covered in blood. And actually, I think it was a dog's bone and it was some red dye. The next task was sipping from a cup with a dead insect in it. There was also putting their hands into a bowl of used condoms. Actually, they weren't used.
No, I think they in fact used lubricant.
Okay.
To make them appear.
you
use your imagination.
Okay, and then they also did things like giving a shirt to the participants and telling them to hug it, and then saying that was worn by a paedophile to rape a child.
Yeah,
who are these scientists?
Yeah, very, just really odd.
I'm not sure if there's a historical thing about, you know, that is the thing that really, really disgusts people. Where do they come up with this list of...
I don't know. And then another one was sticking a needle into a cow's eyeball. So lots of different disgusting tasks. And there were different areas of disgust. There was kind of contamination disgust, moral disgust.
Yeah, obviously where those... pretty nasty ones come in.
Yeah, there was different types to kind of see if it affected all these different types of disgust. And then the participants had to rate these tasks on a scale of kind of naught to disgusting.
So I think some people couldn't actually go through with it.
Yeah, you know, understandably.
Or they hesitate longer than others.
Yeah, but what they found was that the women who'd watched the arousing video before doing these tasks, they reacted with less disgust to all the stimuli. So they concluded from this that the side effect of sexual arousal is that the world as a whole becomes a little bit less disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, that was what was interesting about the study, was because they used all the different disgust factors. I think in previous studies it was
focusing on just sex.
Yeah, just plain old sexual disgust. So what they found is that it's yeah, the
cow's
world,
eyeball disgust as well.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Wide ranging.
But the Dutch authors did admit that the notions of arousal is heavily reliant on subjective values. You know, some people might even get aroused by a bowl full of old condoms.
Yeah, bloody bones.
I really like the kind of application that this could have in the future, though. Say you know you have to unblock your drains.
Have sex.
You need to get some kind of like mental
sex,
barrier.
You just get aroused.
Okay. Yeah. So just get,
you know.
I'm right. Just going to go on
five
the...
5 minutes yeah. of porn, go do this.
And then I'm going to be ready for the household chores. Hooray.
Excellent. But then also you find it hard to believe that participants involved in any kind of study would believe that these things were real. In a controlled environment, they must be like, well, obviously they're not going to make me put my hand into a bowl of used condoms.
And I think there's also an element of what your peers expect you to say. People are, like you say, if someone has some weird fetish, nobody's going to say, oh, this isn't disgusting to me.
Yeah.
When it plainly is.
Yeah.
Pretty foul.
Well, anyway, I think that it's a fascinating story. And if you go onto the website and look up sex and disgust,
as you would, you can they're have always a read. In my search bar.
But the list of tasks, there were many more of them, and some of them are even more disgusting. Yeah. But we can't.
There are
talk
some
about.
We can't actually say.
Yeah. The dog one.
Oh, God.
I'll just leave it there. I'll leave it there. Anyway, David.
Yes, from sex.
From sex to cars.
To cars.
You're a bit of a autophile? Is that? No, mechanophile?
Mechanophile.
There are people who love
like
Pistonhead.
Pistonhead.
I wouldn't say that I am...
You
any means aroused, but no, there are people who do.
A lot of people.
I watched a documentary on Channel 4 once about it, but
right.
That's a story
well,
for another time.
Well, let's move on to the McLaren P1.
McLaren P1. So yes, essentially the Paris Motor Show is getting underway between the 29th of September to the 14th of October. It's a very big deal. It's the International Motor Show, so it gives an opportunity for lots of manufacturers to come and show off their latest concept cars and their future releases. And it's the first time that McLaren Automotive, so the guys behind the F1 and the Formula 1 team, it's their first actual appearance at the International Motor Show. In anticipation for the show, the Woking-based manufacturer have released details of their latest supercar, the McLaren P1. And you should head over to the site to have a look at the pictures, because it's a very, very sexy looking car.
Okay,
just to check, it's a supercar. It's a road car, right?
It is.
It's not the F1 round the track car.
No, it's not. It's a class above a sports car.
Yeah.
So they've got a sports car at the moment called the 12C, which is it's sort of a supercar. It's more livable. You can live with it. You could feasibly go down
a
the shops in
saloon.
Not quite. I mean, you wouldn't do the shopping in it. The 12C is still a very nice car, but this one, the numbers are probably going to be a little bit more impressive, so it makes it a supercar.
Okay, so McLaren have had a supercar before, right?
They have,
yes. A legendary supercar.
They did. The P1 actually marks the 20th anniversary of when they released their seminal supercar, the McLaren F1, which if you're a car fan, the F1 is one of the greatest cars of all time. It held the record as the fastest production car in the world from 1992 to 2005.
Wow.
Which in terms of building like mechanical as a feat of engineering, that's staggering to have a car that held that for 13 years.
As someone who doesn't drive, so I probably shouldn't comment on this, what is the point of having a car that can drive faster than any others when we have a national speed limit?
Oh, Leah.
Oh, dear. Well, it's a valid question, because you ask why
yeah,
why would
Germany.
You throw all
What's
that money
point?
Away? It's something that you could say the engineering that goes into supercars. It's a supercar is a chance for an engineer to basically just let their mind go wild. It's the chance for them to do the impossible or try and stretch the barriers, which can then inform their later builds on other cars. So for instance, the car that's now the quickest in the world is called the Bugatti Veyron, which is owned by the VW, the Volkswagen group. The actual production costs of the Bugatti are more than how much they sell it for. So they actually make a loss.
They do it to
with
show off.
Every single, yeah, it's the chance for the engineers to go wild.
And I guess, Leah, our office is in Mayfair. We are continually surrounded by douchebags in their supercars, revving up their engines, driving very quickly for 10 metres,
screeching
their
brakes.
You can
go from like 0 to 20 in Mayfair in however many seconds. Well, but you're not really upping your game there with the...
I think this goes back to the sex story we were just talking about. But anyway, let's talk about this.
Yeah, so basically the P1 is marking this 20-year anniversary. Now, the executive chairman of McLaren, Ron Dennis, has spoken about the P1, saying that 20 years ago, we raised the supercar performance bar with the McLaren F1, and our goal with the McLaren P1 is to redefine it once again. So they've moved from raising the bar to redefining the bar. Now, this is probably because the P1 will not be able to match the top speed of the current fastest production car, as I said, the Bugatti Veyron Supersport, which is...
A ridiculous.
It's 400...
Oh, I love this semantic gameplay.
It is. The Veyron at the moment has got a top speed of 415 kilometres
That's
per hour.
That's teasing the consumer. He's never going to...
Autobahn.
Autobahn. Or chances are you could probably afford a track day if you can afford that car. Mm. So what they've said, the McLaren Automotive Managing Director, Anthony Sheriff, has stated that the P1's aim is not to necessarily be the fastest in absolute top speed, but be the quickest and most rewarding series production road car on a circuit. So if you read in between the lines... That, for me, seems to be that McLaren is saying, like, yeah, we're never going to compete with Bugatti. What we've got is a very quick, really good circuit car that might be able to compete in a race from 0 to 100, but just isn't really going to be able to match up to the top speeds.
Okay. But it's rewarding.
It's rewarding, yeah.
And so, based on the pictures, you know, knowing a lot about cars and knowing about some of the speculation that's out there, what can we expect from the vehicle?
It's nowhere near as big as a Bugatti Veyron. It's quite a compact, curvy car. It's got some really big air intakes and sculpted curves along the side to force the air into the engine areas and the areas that you need to cool down. So yeah, it's going to be most probably a V8 engine with two turbochargers, which will generate a lot of power. But they're thinking that because of the McLaren Formula One heritage, Formula One is again pushing the boundaries of what you can apply to car manufacturing and how do you get the best out of a car. And they've got a system called the KERS system, which is a kinetic energy recovery system. So whenever the car is braking or slowing down. These have already made appearances in BMW road cars. So whenever the car is slowing down or using the brakes, you're wasting energy. But with KERS, you can regain that energy in an electric charge, which you can then push back into the engine to compress the fuel to put more air in and thus generate more horsepowers into the actual car. So that's
and
the kind of thing that might be
I
there.
I mean, how much was the F1 roughly? How much did that cost at the time? Or now, I guess, if you wanted to buy one?
Now it would be, I mean, we're talking millions.
Okay.
I think it was around the million mark. They didn't build that many of them. It was more the fact it's a limited run.
Yeah.
And it was they had loads of different versions. This one that's coming, the speculation on the current P1, because they haven't released any more information on it, people are putting numbers out there of around 800,000.
But they're throwing that out
there. They're throwing that out there. It's the rumours that go. But it's basically, it'll be more expensive and a better car than the current car that McLaren make, which is called the 12C. They will show off the production version next year. Mm. So after December, they've not been specific. And then within a year, so some point at the end of 2013, they will most probably put that production car into production.
Okay. So none of us will be able to afford that?
No, probably not.
I can't drive.
Unless
bad news
anyone.
Bears. Yeah. Bad news bears. Our final part of the show today is a little report we have from our dear editor, Nate Langson. Now, he's currently at the Tokyo Game Show in Japan, obviously, Tokyo, Japan. And he has sent us this report.
Ahoy hoy, Nate here, checking in from Japan. I've travelled here for the Tokyo Game Show and to meet some game directors. Although actually, the first day I was here, I was chased down the street in Akihabara by a girl dressed as a maid who wanted me to visit her mermaid cafe. Sadly, I was actually technically working that day, so I had to sprint off in the opposite direction, but I will probably go back at some point next week. The game show is actually a bit mad. Before I hit the show floor, though, one of the most interesting things I saw was at Sony's studio. It was a game called Tokyo Jungle. Now, I met up with the director of the game, which is out in November, I think. And just to give you an example of how mad this game is, I thought you might like to hear a few questions I had to ask during my Q&A session. These are my actual recordings straight off my dictation machine. Have a listen.
Where does that retriever get the schoolgirl outfit and the gas mask from? There's no way a rabbit's going to take down a mammoth, is there?
It's like eating a mammoth.
And I take it the chicken can lay eggs and they hatch to chicks. I've just never seen a retriever battle a kangaroo.
Like you,
you don't go to the right place.
So, yes, mad. The idea of the game is that you play as one of 80 animals in a kind of post-apocalyptic Tokyo where humans are no longer inhabiting the Earth, and dogs, cats, chickens, and mammoths, crocodiles, chimps, and a whole bunch more besides basically run the show. You need to survive the longest and discover from these various different animals' perspectives why humans are AWOL, basically while mating, killing, and feeding in order to take control of Tokyo and outlast the other species. It's kind of like a beast-based action survival game, and it is utterly bonkers. And to answer my own questions that you heard earlier, the dog got his schoolgirl outfit from the corpse of a schoolgirl because clothes and items apparently give you various bonus strengths. A rabbit can take down a mammoth, but it'll take several hours of gnawing at its legs, according to the director. As a chicken, you can lay eggs and hatch chicks, which grow into chickens and help you build a giant chicken clan. And watching a golden retriever have a fight with a kangaroo is not only possible, but also a huge daft amount of fun. So I was also at the press conference where Sony unveiled a redesigned PS3 with bigger hard drives up to 500 gig. It's basically the same general aesthetic, but is now half the size and weight of the original model and has a top-loading disk drive bay instead of a slot-loading one. It's going to be out in October for probably around the same cost as the current slim model. There's also a 12 gig flash-based version that will cost less than the hard drive models for people who don't really need storage and probably just want to use the system as a media center or for casual games. Gaming. Another mad game that I saw was Puppeteer. It's really hard to describe, actually, and in fact the game's director told me that that was one of the game's biggest challenges, because walking into a room full of Sony marketing guys basically just gets blank expressions when trying to explain what the game's about. But it's essentially this sort of platform game based around a very dark fairy tale. And you play this wooden puppet guy called Kutaro, who contains the trapped soul of a boy who was captured and sent to the moon in order to be a slave. Now, as this wooden boy, you're accompanied by a floating talking cat called Ying Yang, and need to find and utilize a pair of enchanted scissors and various interchangeable heads in order to escape the clutches of a bear king who lives in a castle on the moon. Yeah, I've seen some pretty mad stuff out here, although none as weird as my hotel toilet, which quite frankly scares the hell out of me. It has more buttons than my phone, and I've never in history had to tell a toilet to stand by because I wasn't quite ready to use it. Mad stuff. So that's about it from me. If you do check out wired.co.uk, you'll find my reports from Puppeteer and some of the other games I've seen. Plus, I met up with the president of Sony's Worldwide Development Studios to find out how games are made simultaneously for both the PS3 and the Vita. So if you search for Sony Develops Vita, you'll find a Q&A there that's well worth reading, I think, if you're interested in the tech behind this kind of development. Now I'm off to a cat cafe to quite literally have tea and kittens. Maybe later I'll find that mermaid cafe and see what that maid was going on about. So, arigato gozaimasu and sayonara.
Thank you very much, Nate. It sounds incredibly exciting and I'm pleased he's finally made it out to Japan. Now, that is the show. Well done, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here. Liat, can you tell people how they can get in touch with us?
But of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Wired UK or check out our Facebook page. Otherwise, if you're old school, email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Okay, we're out of time. Thanks very much for listening and we'll catch up with you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Cheerio.
Thank you.
I was moved deeply.
Moved. The cow's eye was moved.
Yeah.
Moved. Oh, that was terrible. Okay.